It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome back to the Career Profiles podcast. I'm your host, Sean, and this is another episode for you guys to get your ears around. It is an episode on a fighter in boxing history who we have covered in some capacity. We enjoyed his legendary night's tale about 2 years ago with a certain Mr. Tony Zale. But this particular character is a legend in his own right. He fought in difficult times. He fought in difficult circumstances. He was a bit of a Jack the Lad. He was a rugged individual who fought through hard times, fought through adversity, and came out the other side of it and goes down as one of boxing's greats. Whilst he might not be technically a gifted fighter, he certainly had the heart, determination, and ultimate desire to move on in his career to go on and be a world champion. We are talking about the great Rocky Graziano. I really enjoyed Rocky Graziano's legendary night with Tony Zale. And I know Johnston, when he covered it, he also really enjoyed that particular episode. And we always said we'd cover Rocky at some point down the line. So for me, it felt very apt for this season to be covering Rocky Graziano's career profile. I'm excited to go through this story with you guys. We've got some great stories, some great production in the background from our man Jamie Albrecht, who has put together a great story on Rocky Graziano and some great moments that I think you guys will really enjoy hearing about. And if you're fans or if you're historians or budding historians and you've done a little bit of research yourself on Rocky Graziano, well, I hope that we're able to deliver something that you haven't already heard. It's something we pride ourselves upon in this show, and we hope you enjoy it. So to begin, the man who would be known to the world as Rocky Graziano was born Thomas Rocco Barbella on New Year's Day in 1919 on Rivington Street on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, New York. It was a street of Italian immigrants, and one could hear their voices all along the street. There were mothers yelling to their children, children laughing with their friends, fathers home from poorly paid labouring jobs also yelling for their kids to get upstairs for dinner. Many of those families migrated to America from Naples in Italy, or small towns not far from those climes. Like many children in that neighbourhood, Rocco was brought into the world by a midwife. His mother, Ida Skinto, groaned in pain whilst delivering him on an old mattress, not really fit for a woman, glowing with the miracle of pregnancy. Rocco's father, Nicola Barbella, a sometime boxing pro with a less than stellar record, barely celebrated the arrival of his newborn son. Instead, he shot dice and drank beer in a front room with his boxing pals, all of whom were unemployed and playing for a quick buck. Rivington Street did not contain the family for long. Looking for less costly accommodation, the family moved to Brooklyn, possibly with heavy pockets owing to not paying the rent, as was the unfortunate custom in many a poor area in early 20th century America. There, a young Rocco, as he became known, found the streets to be a school for fledgling tough guys. Anything you wanted on the Brooklyn streets, you gained by being tough. Tougher than the next guy, ready and willing to fight the world. You wanted anything, you had to take it. If you were scared to use force, someone else would. As he grew, Rocco became increasingly unruly. He had an insatiable need to be one of those tough guys. He was a child of the streets, and he knew how to satisfy his immediate needs with his fists. The streets were his university in favour of a more traditional educational setting. Rocco was illiterate. If asked about attending school, he would have said it was a waste of time. A form of enslavement. Roaming the streets looking for trouble, that was the life young Rocco chose from the outset. Scrawny, wiry, tough, the red-haired Rocco had the lean, hungry look of one on the make of a panther hunting its next meal, its next victim. Rocco would spot another kid eating a hot dog and pounce, grabbing the food out of the kid's hands. Rocco moved so quickly, his victim barely had time to register the attack. In a grim precursor to his fighting days, Rocco would throw a hard right to the kid's face, and another to his belly, and then a third to his face again. All the while, his left hand kept a tight grip on the stolen food. He would leave his victim bloodied and crying, whilst he walked away on the hunt once more. Rocco's mother couldn't control him. His father's beatings with a leather strap didn't stop him either, only adding to his resentment of the world and bolstering his anger. His mother despaired. Her sadness descended into depression. She became a heavy drinker. It was her escape from the horrors of life. As days and nights of drinking increased, she began talking to herself, babbling nonsensically. Screeching laughter erupted from her mouth. She screamed and yelled, she swore and sobbed. When Nicola couldn't figure out what the hell had happened to his wife, he took her to Kings County Hospital. There she was diagnosed as having a nervous breakdown. Rocco adored his mum. She had never tormented him. He was the sunshine in her darkness. But she hated his tearaway approach to life. It darkened her mood and set her on a course of endless worry. When his mother was taken away, Rocco's anger and confusion would ignite still further, leading him to more recklessness and skullduggery. With his mother held in hospital, his home was dominated by his father and his brother Joey. Unable to tolerate them, he slept on benches, in abandoned cellars, and occasionally at the apartment of one of his friend's parents' house. When he did return home, there would be his father instructing Joey on how to be the next world champ. Nicola would be demonstrating the perfect left, the power of a right cross. He would show Joey how to weave and feint. Rocco wanted to flatten both of them and run away. Far away. The wayward Rocco would be sent by his father, Nicola, to live with his grandparents on Manhattan's Lower East Side. His grandparents treated Rocco with love and the affection that his father's custody lacked. They fed him nourishing meals. He even had his own bedroom. They made him attend school, which he only did sporadically, but nevertheless he attended. Although his home life had improved, he was still a menace to anyone who got in his way. You bump into him on the pavement, and he would retaliate, push you onto the street. It didn't matter how big you were. If you had a sled or a bicycle he wanted, he simply took it. If you resisted or complained, you got a hard fist crashing against your unwitting head. Rocco had now become Rocky. His new friends called him Rocky Bob, a type of homage to his dad, universally known by New York locals as Nick Bob. Young Rocky was an unrepentantly angry. Angry at the world, angry at his mother, angry at his father and brother, angry at his lack of money and fortune, as he had ever been. He would take his revenge against the world. While living with his parents in a cold water railroad flat in a Brooklyn tenement, Rocky was tasked to steal coal from local coal cellars and dumped the stolen chunks and bricks into the Barbella's potbelly stove, which stood in the centre of the kitchen. It was the only source of heat for four tiny rooms. At his grandparents' apartment, such labour wasn't needed. Rocky was warm and well kept. In opposition to the bitter New York winters, the summers in the Barbella residence were ridiculously hot. The family spent hours on the tar-papered roof known as Tar Beach. The bedroom Rocky shared with his brother and sister at least had a fire escape, a poor family's version of a terrace or balcony. In his grandparents' apartment, he enjoyed the luxury of having his own bedroom. In Brooklyn, to help put food on the family's table, Rocky would dig for clams at the beach to replenish the family's food supply. It was the family's only source of protein. At his grandparents' apartment, he enjoyed the food that was brought home from a local grocer, a fishmonger, a butcher, and a bakery. Rocky didn't think life had become easy, but he did feel that the harsh realities had softened. The Lower East Side was still a tough neighbourhood, however. There were gangs of street thugs roaming around and numerous mafia social clubs. Rocco felt he was a born fighter, trained by fighting Nick Bob and with an arsenal owned by his own street battles. He knew the rules of the streets. Fight or be bullied. Survive or die. It was up to you. As he wrote about one of his fights in his autobiography, Somebody Up There Likes Me, he said, "Thumb in his eyes, knee in his groin. If I have to fight dirty, I will fight dirty." It wasn't fighting that got Rocco into trouble with the law. It was stealing. He and his gang of five thugs stole whatever wasn't nailed down and could be resold for any profit that would suffice. They also stole suits, shirts, hats and shoes so they could copy their screen idols, the gangsters of cinema. They stole watches, clocks and radios, anything that could be fenced. It wasn't a great deal of money, a few dollars at a time in fact, but it was just enough to keep the gang in food. None of them went to school, not with any regularity anyway. Life was lived on the streets, on the rooftops of their apartment blocks, and briefly in the premises of burgled stores. As would be expected of any young tearaway, up to no good, the local police would take umbrage with Rocco's nefarious activities, and soon he was arrested. He was sent to a Catholic protectorate after a trial in a family court. There, he enhanced his tough reputation by beating up the head of a gang. He was eventually released and quickly returned to the street life. He was caught and sent back. He would escape, giving him a feeling of invincibility and making him feel like the most daring man in New York. However, it turned out that the police wouldn't be on his trail for his latest crime. He was only actually wanted by the local truant officer. His self-styled gangsterism quickly evaporated. Rocco continued stealing and fighting. As he got older, he was sentenced to serve time in prisons that would not be as cushy as the Catholic protector is. Rocco was embarking on a long road to nowhere, much to the ever-present dismay of his long-suffering mother, Ida. Ida was desperate to save her son, but she had no idea on how to launch his conversion from criminal to upstanding citizen. One day, after his release from jail, she would despair once more as Rocco would sneak into the bedroom he had shared with his brother Joey. There, he waited patiently for his brother's arrival, akin to a lion stalking a zebra. As soon as Joey entered the room, Rocco uncorked his rage, raining his fist down on Joey in an act of stone-cold revenge for the years of abuse that Joey had assisted his father with inflicting upon Rocco. It was clear that Rocky would need an outlet to channel this fury, and boxing would heed the call. Rocco would meet another young man with a vaunted reputation shortly after this incident with Joey in 1939, a kid named Terry Young who wanted to be a professional boxer. That's where the money and glory were. The two became firm friends and often went to the local boys' club together. There, Rocco would watch Terry hit the speed bag and the body bag, skip rope and shadow box. Terry was a skillful boxer who thought he might have a chance to make it big as a pro. To Rocco, it looked like fun, but not if you had to work for anything. Rocco could not handle discipline. He did things his way, and if anyone contradicted this, Lord help them. Training represented a lot of work, requiring much self-discipline. Despite his misgivings, Terry convinced Rocco to enter the club's boxing competition when, during a sparring session, Rocco delivered a nuclear blow to Terry's chin that left him flat on his back. Terry, stunned rather than upset, would exclaim with excitement, "You're a real fighter." Without saying a word, Rocco nodded in agreement, opening his mind to a new, legitimate life path. He entered the tournament, knocking out his seemingly overmatched opponent with a fast flurry of lefts and rights. After the fight, feeling contempt for his former opponent and forgetting about his fleeting change in values, Rocco proceeded to go through the pockets of his beaten opponent's clothes, reverting to his usual thievery. While pilfering a few coins, he was caught and subsequently expelled from the club. It was a sad end to an otherwise victorious evening. To make matters worse, the man Rocco had knocked out went on to win the club championship. And so, Rocco's initiation into the career of a boxer had ended before he could even gain any serious traction. With his shameful episode behind him, Rocco continued his old faithful routine of street fights and more burglary, more delusions of rising to the top of the rackets, of being one of the kingpins, the feared men of the underworld. Yet Terry kept urging Rocco to return to boxing. That's where his future was. It was a vision that Rocco couldn't share with his friend. Unable or unwilling to explain what had happened to him, Rocco laughed at Terry's ambitions for him, not believing in himself.
I'm Victoria Cash. Thanks for calling the Lucky Land Hotline. If you feel like you do the same thing every day, press 1. If you're ready to have some serious fun for the chance to redeem some serious prizes, press 2. We heard you loud and clear. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com right now and play over 100 social casino-style games for free. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
It's time for today's Lucky Land Horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
He treated Terry as a naive dreamer. Still, the seed of a boxing career had been surreptitiously planted in Rocco's psyche. While too embarrassed and angry to return to the boys' club, Rocco would instead regroup at the Red Range Athletic Club with members of his gang never far behind. Terry Young would again appear with boxing on his mind for the young gang member, whilst at the Red Range. He presented a new opportunity for Rocco, calling him Rocky in tandem with the name of his gang, Rocky Bob. Terry told him that Joe Giuliani, an aspiring boxer, was sick and could not compete in the New York City Amateur Athletic Union Boxing Tournament. Terry pandered Rocky to take Joe's place. He appealed to his ego, telling him that he was a top welterweight and he would surely win. Having experienced the power of Rocky's right hook, Terry knew it could deliver Rocky the championship. The boys continued to argue, Rocky treating the idea of boxing as something less than a joke, while Terry kept urging Rocky to use his talents to become an amateur champ. The day ended with neither side convincing the other, but the seeds of doubt had been planted in Rocky's mind. It would make his mother proud. It would also show up his father, who never really thrived in the ring. The next day, Rocky met Terry in front of the boys' club. Terry introduced him to Constantine D'Amato. He had been training Joe and was willing to train the fiery Rocky. Having watched Rocky's lack of technique, D'Amato explained to him that he must learn to jab with his left hand. He just couldn't keep throwing his right as powerful as it was. He needed to learn defensive intricacies too. He couldn't just charge bull-like towards his opponent, going hell for leather and expect to win. The fight was scheduled to take place in the Broadway Arena in Brooklyn. Despite D'Amato's extensive attempts to polish the rough diamond, Rocky would destructively revert to type, detonating a right hook on his opponent to end his maiden bout of the championship in 2 minutes of the first round. A week later, Rocky was entered into the semi-finals. He approached the ring, and there he spotted the same kid he had knocked out a week earlier. When Rocky asked him what he was doing back in the ring, the kid explained that Rocky had not knocked him out. He had knocked out the kid's twin brother. Rocky responded by saying, "Well, kid, I'm going to do you a favour. So your brother won't have anything against you, I'm going to knock you out in the first round too." And true to his prediction, Rocky knocked out the remaining twin in the first round. Rocky now felt he had arrived, that he had achieved something that made him proud, satisfying his yearning for respect, not only from the straight world, but also from the gangsters and the wannabes. From that day on, after I took the city title and got my name in the papers, I couldn't walk down First Avenue or Second or across 10th Street without everybody stopping me, he would recall. Seeing an opportunity to cash in on an up-and-coming young welterweight, the local mafia wise guys and their associates started to drop in on Rocky. Sensing a ready-made moneymaker, they wanted to sign him to a long-term professional deal, making him one of their best assets. Terry Young, however, had seen the fire in Rocky. The wise guys simply saw the dollar signs. The reactions of Rocky's parents to the news were in opposition to one another. His dad boasted about teaching Rocky to fight from the age of three. Of course, that was a sizable lie. His mother was horrified that her beloved son would follow in the footsteps of Nicola, a violent, quarrelsome alcoholic. She begged Rocky not to continue with boxing, protesting instead that he chooses a day job. The mundaneness of family life without incident. Rocky didn't know whether to be amused or angry. He did know that he wouldn't end up like his father, the mediocre and angry fighting Nick Bob, and he would not follow the example of his honest, hard-working older brother Joey. While Rocky was a black sheep among four siblings, he was his own black sheep, and actually not a sheep at all, more like a lone tiger looking to conquer the jungle. Despite early successes at amateur level, Rocky would carve out a journey as a club fighter, initially fighting under the ring name of Robert Barber and earning a modest $15 here and there. He would always win, securing a payday, no matter how seemingly small. Where money wasn't the prize, there was a fancy wristwatch to be adorned by the winner. It would be quickly pawned and the money siphoned into Rocky's pocket. Although he was excelling as a boxer, he still held ambitions to succeed as a wise guy in a romanticised version of a mafia motion picture. Reality remained dominant over fantasy, however, and Rocky was introduced to an influential fight promoter named Eddie Coco, who proceeded to set up a couple of unrecorded bouts for the rising talent. At his first bout in the Bronx, Rocky heard some tough guys sitting at ringside laughing at him. They derided him as a pretty fag. What comedian had put boxing gloves on a guy with such a pretty face? These comments fueled Rocky. He ferociously ran out of his corner and viciously pummeled Vasquez, knocking the guy down. His opponent reluctantly kissed the canvas and made Rocky the winner. After he was declared as such, Rocky heard the same ringside tough guys asking, "Who's that kid?" He punched with the power to elicit notice. Rocky had moved up. His earning capacity had increased too. He was now making more than that $15 a fight, but he was still not in the big money. Earning $35 here or $70 there was certainly an increase, but it was nothing compared to what a good pro could earn. The dreams of being a gangster were waning. Rocky now dreamt of glory in the ring. He could lie half awake and revisit his fights. The dreams were sweet. Rocky began to focus solely on boxing as his career. His gang was dismissed, and he gave Eddie Coco permission to set up one professional bout after another. Rocky felt he was on the way up, and the feeling settled him and gave him a renewed purpose. All the while Rocky was boxing, he was on parole. Unbeknownst to him, he had unwittingly violated many of the rules of his parole. He could not have paid attention to those rules, for simply, he didn't know them. For Rocky, boxing was all that mattered now, and he had not seen the pitfalls of his parole. He was picked up by the cops and dragged off to the station. He shouted that he had done nothing, had committed no crime. It didn't matter. Rocky was charged with statutory rape by his girlfriend's mother, who didn't like her daughter dating a wise guy wannabe. He was locked up, spending a week in jail, and was brought in front of a judge. He thought the judge would go easy on him, owing to his so-called celebrity status. While the rape charge was dropped, Rocky was condemned to 6 months in reform school for breaking the conditions of his parole. Asked if he wished to say anything, Rocky told the judge to go to hell. Rocky served the full term, spending a short time in New York's Rikers Island as well, after being transferred for starting a riot. Upon his release, Rocky finally felt free. Free to pursue his career as a boxer. Free to walk down the streets of New York without the cops accosting him. He felt he could start with a clean slate. He wouldn't have to look over his shoulder and worry about disgracing his mum. He had plans, big plans, and nothing and no one would get in his way. He would find glory at any cost. However, 2 months after his release, his dreams were dashed when he received a draft notice from the US Army. He was to report for his induction into the armed forces. For basic training, he was sent to Governor's Island. From there, he was sent to Fort Dix, New Jersey, with thousands of other young recruits. World War II was raging in Europe and the Pacific, yet Rocky was unconcerned. The only war he cared for was in the ring. The army was Rocky's hell. It was too regimented, with less freedom of choice than you'd have in prison. The officers shouted, "Jump," and the recruits shouted, "How high?" It was demeaning to such a free spirit. Rocky openly defied the army. He rebelled against all orders. He refused to do what he was told to do. "Fuck you," was a common answer to any forceful request. He once battered a corporal. He tried to start up some crap games and organise a small black market operation, and often went AWOL. Finally being brought before one of the fort commanding officers, a captain, Rocky was ordered to stand to attention whilst being loudly disciplined, and was told he was typical of most New York Jews and Italians, and that the army would knock the New York wise guy spirit right out of him. As the angry captain got up from the chair behind his desk, Rocky hit him hard, knocking him over his desk and onto the floor where he lay comatosed. Following that altercation, Rocky managed to sneak out of the camp and make his way back to his parents' apartment on the Lower East Side. It seemed as if Rocky's dreams of becoming a championship fighter would end in another prison sentence. Terry Young would once again represent Rocky's guardian angel upon his return to New York whilst on the run. Young took him to Stillman's Gym, a famous boxing establishment on 8th Avenue in Manhattan. It was where some of the era's most celebrated champions had trained. The facility was managed by Lou Stillman, a gruff-talking ex-cop who perpetually puffed on a cigar and carried a snub-nose .38 caliber pistol in a shoulder holster. He made sure the gym was always filthy. So filthy, in fact, that heavyweight champion Gene Tunney refused to train there. The floors were never swept and the windows were caked in grime, giving the gym a harsh feel. A place where fistic steel was forged. Boxers, trainers and managers loved the place, and so did the fans and bookies who paid to watch the fighters train. Rocky entered Stillman's not knowing he was entering his sanctuary, the place where he would learn to be a world champion, where his eyes would be opened to a prosperous future, one where he would be celebrated as one of the most exciting fighters of his time, as the eventual middleweight champion of the world. Terry introduced Rocky to his old manager, Irving Cohen, who took one look at Rocky and told him not to become a pro fighter. He thought Rocky was too good looking to get his face messed up, to wear scar tissue above and below his eyes, or to get his nose flattened and his ears remodelled. And worse still, suffer brain damage. Irving described one such sad case who, while sitting at ringside, began trembling at the sound of the bell. He said, "If you knew what it was like, you wouldn't want to be a fighter. Take my advice. You look like a good kid, a smart fellow. You go find yourself a job that pays $50 a week and you'll be thankful you listened to me." Rocky, of course, refused to accept that advice. He asked to have a fight, to get into the ring and impress Irving with his skills and power. Following Terry's urging to give Rocky a chance, Irving caved. Rocky changed into a pair of boxing shorts. He had his fist tape, put on a pair of gloves and entered the ring to fight the former middleweight champion of Argentina. Rocky, eager to show his stuff and collect a few dollars, knocked out the Argentinian with a hard right cross to the guy's left temple. He landed on the canvas with a thump. Before the referee could count to 10, Irving Cohen had changed his opinion. He wanted to manage Rocky and get him one of the best trainers in the business. Whitey Bimstein. Rocky refused. Training meant discipline, and Rocky didn't do discipline. He left quickly, letting Irving know he would only be back when professional fights had been arranged for him. Rocky's career as a free man was short-lived. He was eventually picked up by two military policemen and was on his way back to prison. After being locked up for a short while, he was told he should return to Fort Dix, where he would be subject to a court-martial. He was also told that no guards would accompany him to the fort. He would be on his own. If he proved himself honourable and didn't abscond from his trial, his sentence would be reduced. Instead of returning to Fort Dix, Rocky returned to Stillman's gym. He conferred with Irving Cohen, to whom he lied, saying he had been away to get his discharge from the army. Irving didn't know Rocky's surname, and he needed it to obtain a boxing licence for his new charge. Not willing to use his real name in case he was being hunted, Rocky informed Irving that his surname was Graziano, the surname of a friend, Dominic, who had been taken to jail himself. Surely he wouldn't protest too much. Irving set up a series of fights for Rocky. First, in what would be his pro debut, he took on a fighter named Curtis Hightower on March 31st, 1942, knocking him out in the second round of a fight staged at the Broadway Arena. After that win,
step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Rocky was signed to fight Mike Mastandre. He too went down for the count, though this time in the third, and Rocky was now developing a following. Rocky finally felt he was sitting atop of the world despite a loss on points over four against Miami's Charles Ferguson in April. His world was about to collapse yet again. While in the office of the New York State Athletic Commission on Worth Street in Manhattan for a pre-fight weigh-in, Rocky was confronted by two cops. It was June 1942, and the game of cat and mouse was over. Rocky had been captured, and a court-martial sentenced him to 1 year of hard labour for desertion from the army. He would serve his time at Fort Leavenworth, a prison for deserters and hardened career criminals. Rocky was like a fish back in water, reverting to his old gang leader mentality. He won the respect of some tough gang members who had initially attempted to intimidate the short but very capable fighter. Rocky was only 5'7", but he challenged the leader of the toughest prison gang, a 6'4" illiterate hillbilly named Harvey Miller. Rocky's unwavering ferocity and dogged determination were enough for the two men to become friends. he would listen in awe as Rocky recounted tales of his old gang-led exploits. When Harvey told Rocky he wanted to find Jews to beat up, Rocky introduced him to his pal, Julie Kaplan. Harvey, who had never met a Jew, refused to believe that Kaplan was a Jew, explaining that he wasn't the devil, he didn't have the horns. Rocky explained that Jews looked like everyone else and that Julie was his friend and should be respected too. Harvey was amazed, but accepted Rocky's friend as another prison colleague, sweeping aside his prejudice. It was another man, Sergeant Johnny Highland, who gave Rocky the opportunity to prove that he was a truly promising prospect in the arena of controlled combat. Rocky had begged the sergeant to let him join the boxing squad, but the sergeant sneered at Rocky's short height and pretty face. Rocky finally said he would fight anyone the sergeant wanted to put in the ring against him. The sergeant, seeing an opportunity to humble the upstart, put him in against a light heavyweight named Brownie Davis from Chicago. Brownie was a big, solidly muscled boxer who was inches taller than Rocky. Once in the ring, both men squared off and Brownie began pummeling the shorter, lighter man. Rocky, who was able to absorb an extraordinary amount of punishment, was letting Brownie deliver punch after punch. While fending off some of the punches and landing a few, Rocky was waiting for an opening. He feinted with a left. Brownie went to block it, and Rocky landed his devastating right cross to Brownie's left temple. The light heavyweight sagged to the canvas like a sack of potatoes. The sergeant thought it was a lucky punch, though Brownie assured him it was nothing of the kind, brimming with integrity. Rocky went on to beat one opponent after another. The army brought in welterweights and middleweights, not only from the prison, but also from military camps throughout the country. Rocky beat them all. He was now a hero, and with such exalted status came special privileges. The sergeant allowed Rocky to choose Julie Kaplan as his manager and let Harvey, although awkward and flat-footed, fight as a heavyweight. Rocky was finally enjoying his life in prison. He had the comfort of his pals and plenty of time to reflect on his life. Rocky was now becoming self-aware. He was able to evaluate the stupid moves he had made throughout the years and appreciate the possibility of a legitimate life as a professional boxer. Once out of Leavenworth, he would finally concentrate on the straight path. A path with a manager in Irving Cohen and a boxing trainer in Whitey Bimsteen to provide as much motivation as possible for Rocky to court legitimacy. Maurice Whitey Bimsteen was one of the best trainers in America. As a professional boxer residing at bantamweight, Whitey had 70 fights and his face was a tattooed reminder of those long-gone days. His pink oval face, with puffy tufts of snowy white hair shooting out on the sides of his rounded cranium, gave him the look of a favourite uncle. His colouring and features led many people, upon first meeting him, to think he was of Irish descent, a small pink leprechaun of a man. But ethnicity mattered little to Whitey. He lived in the world of boxing where men were judged by their skill, not their ethnicity, race or religion. A boxer was a boxer, and he was distinguished by his talent and technical skill and, of course, his ability to win. Whitey was brilliant at motivating his fighters. Vinnie Ferguson, a contemporary middleweight of the time, described Whitey as one of the best psychologists in the world. He said this of him: "He would light a fire under you. He'd maybe tell you that the other guy insulted you or something. He knew how to get things out of guys. He'd say, 'This guy can't carry your gym bag,' or 'This guy is a baby compared to you.'" Whitey had a reputation as a tough guy, someone who only cared about winning. It was not true. He was devoted to his fighters, first and foremost. He taught them how to protect themselves, how to maintain the highest levels of physical fitness and well-being. Whitey made sure they ate regularly and got sufficient sleep. Indeed, when it came to his boxers, he cared for them like a father to his sons. To Whitey, being a trainer meant you protected your boxers, catering to their every need, both physical and psychological. Bimsteen was a combination of psychologist, gym teacher, boxing trainer, father confessor, a friend, motivational speaker. He loved a good drink and rarely got drunk. He loved a good meal and often ate enough for two or three larger men. He seemed like a larger-than-life character animated from the pages of a novel. For his ability as a cutman alone, Whitey was the elite. He had stitched cuts, staunched bleeding lips and noses, and opened eyes that had been swollen shut. He did it all in a matter of seconds between rounds, and with a level of tender loving care not consistent with the violence of the ring. His fighters would do whatever he told them to do, and he never gave bad advice. Mistakes were not in his itinerary. Every word was thoughtfully chosen with success in mind. He knew how to exploit a foe's weakness and carve a path to victory. Whitey had been a cornerman for some of the greatest names in boxing. Names like Harry Greb, Gene Tunney, James J. Braddock, Tony Galento and Rocky Marciano, they were listed among his clientele. If ever there had been a championship for boxing trainers, Whitey would have been in perpetual contention. It was Rocky's good fortune that such a behemoth came into his life. Without Whitey's knowledge, skills and paternal-like attentiveness, Rocky may have continued to stray from life straight and narrow, choosing crime over boxing. And if he hadn't been a boxer, Rocky very well could have become a lifer at a federal penitentiary, as many of his friends had become. Irving Cohen, Rocky's brilliant and empathetic manager, had seen potential in the young, rebellious Rocco. Cohen knew Rocky was raw and unschooled. He needed a trainer, and Whitey would be ideal for the young man with the world on his shoulders. And while Rocky was steadfast in his determination to not train and unwilling to submit himself, being taught by even the most experienced of men, he knew that boxing would provide an avenue to keep him away from the streets. If he didn't train, he might wind up like his pal Terry Young. Terry, whose real name was Angelo Di Zanza, could never be a legitimate guy. He had spent years being a thief. He'd spent years in prison. He was a hold-up man who led a crew of gun-toting robbers. Boxing had not provided him with a way out of his life of crime. He was a talented boxer, more than proficient, and promoters thought he might one day become a lightweight or welterweight champ. Throughout the 1940s, he seemed on the verge of becoming a champion. He had beaten a former titleist in Bo Jack, one of the best fighters of the era. Terry won 55 out of 69 fights, 17 by knockout. As good as he was not a Pied Piper type of fighter. The crowds would not flock to see him box as they would his friend Rocky. This would instill a jealousy towards Rocky. It was Terry who brought Rocco into this world. Surely he deserved the breaks. He had been a thief like Rocky since his early teenage years, and it would lead to a conviction for armed robbery and a sentence for 2.5 to 5 years in Sing Sing Prison in 1943, where he was 31 years old. His end as a thief, a boxer, and all-around career criminal was a sad story. Terry was shot dead at an East Side social club, the Playboy Social Club, where Terry often spent many hours in the company of fellow criminals. Photos of him in the ring were posted on the walls, although Terry was never an official member of the club. One night, while socialising, Terry was shot in the back. He had been drinking in the back of the club, and after being shot, managed to stagger to the entrance, where he collapsed and succumbed to his fate. He was only 46 years old. A few local newspapers noted his passing, detailing his record as a fighter. A couple mentioned his criminal record. The tale of Terry Young would provide a grim inspiration for Rocky. He was done with his gangland shtick, his crime. Whitey Bimstein represented new opportunities for Rocky. He would not only save the future champion physically, but also embed in him the values that would replace those that had guided his life as a young thug and criminal. The two men developed a close relationship, teacher and student, and ultimately, friends. While Irving Cohen mapped out Rocky's future from fight to fight, Whitey navigated his fighter through the roadblocks, the hidden curves and dead ends that could have kept Rocky from reaching his goal, the middleweight championship of the world. It was Whitey's persuasiveness that softened Rocky's attitude towards training, leading him to sharpen his attributes. It was Rocky's ambition to be a success, his drive to one day be the middleweight champion that inspired Whitey to never give up on his student. Yet, as much as Rocky wanted to learn from Whitey, he could never completely give up his defiance of being given orders. Training was like going to school, and he hated both. But he wanted the recognition, and even more so, the financial rewards that came with being a champion. Whitey's quote about training could just as easily have been uttered by Rocky. In his book, Corner Men, he is quoted as saying, "I hated school and I hated training. It didn't make sense to me in those days that a fighter had to waste all that time fooling around with punching bags and getting up at dawn so that he could chase his shadow on the park." Rocky was indeed Whitey's most difficult project, though they worked because of a shared disdain for parts of life. They were both rebels, haters of rules, haters of authority. Of course, Whitey no longer had to train as a boxer. He was the trainer, and Rocky was the trainee. Speaking of Rocky, Whitey is quoted as stating, "You gotta give guys who punch with Rocky, or he don't like it. Give him a boxer in the gym, and it's no good." In the beginning, we had trouble getting Rocky in the gym, but once he started to make money, I had no trouble getting Graziano to work. Rock can be very serious about money. As time passed and Whitey's reputation grew, he was fast becoming a legend. And he did so, attracting many former boxers who wanted to become trainers too. Whitey's most outstanding young protege was Al Silvane, who had witnessed his older brother, a professional boxer, being badly beaten in a bout due to poor advice from his trainer. Silvane, who also briefly boxed, decided he wanted to become a trainer for this reason, to prevent boxers from being injured because they had not been properly trained. For Silvane, training equaled success in the ring. Whitey hired him, and Silvane assisted him in training Rocky. Describe Rocky as a rough piece of work, a guy who had a powerful right by saying, "He'd always choke you with his left hand and hit you with the right hand and knock your head in." Silvane was developing his own reputation as a winning trainer. Young boxers who couldn't get a slot with Whitey sought out Silvane instead. In 1941, a young Frank Sinatra showed up at Stillman's gym and requested that Silvane give him boxing lessons. He agreed to coach the then rising crooner, who was just making a name for himself in the basic elements of boxing. At the time Sinatra met Silvane in Stillman's gym, he weighed about 119 pounds. The boxing gloves and boxing shorts made him look like an undeferred young boy, drawing ridicule from onlookers. Silvane didn't follow suit. He had seen plenty of lightweight, featherweight and bantamweight fighters, and size didn't matter. Anyone with the right timing, coordination and flexibility could be taught to box. Silvane liked Sinatra, appreciating his willingness to learn. The two would become lifelong friends, and Sinatra remained a hardcore fan of boxing, befriending many of the sports gladiators, including Rocky, whom he would cast in his 1967 detective film, Tony Rome. In addition to casting Rocky in that movie, Sinatra, who was known for his kindness and generosity towards those who had stood by him, repaid Silvane by getting him small parts in not only Tony Rome, but also Ocean's 11, Robin and the Seven Hoods, and From Here to Eternity. Silvane proved to be a natural actor, even securing himself a part screen as a cornerman in the first three Rocky movies. Whilst Rocky bolstered the tools of his professional trade inside Stillman's gym, his life outside took a turn for the better too. Norma Unger was a beautiful, oval-faced, dark-haired Jewish teenager. She was of German descent and lived with her mother and stepfather on Ocean Parkway in Brooklyn, an affluent Jewish neighbourhood. Norma loved to hang out on the Lower East Side, where she met and befriended Yolanda Barbella, Rocky's sister. Although one was Jewish and the other Catholic, one was of German extraction and the other Italian, and one was middle class and the other from a less working class family, the two girls fast became friends. Their separate worlds met in their shared interests. On most weekends, the two met and laughed, bonding over shared interests. In Norma, Yolanda saw a stabilizing influence for her marauding brother, who she felt would end up resigned to a life of criminality without her. Yolanda did not want to be the sister of a convict, and so She regaled Norma with stories about her handsome, restless brother, so daring and headstrong, like a character from the movies the friend so freely dreamed about. She was determined to play Cupid. On a few occasions, she tried to get them to date one another. Rocky had no interest in dating Norma, though. He could set up his own dates. He didn't need his sister interfering in his life. When she couldn't get Rocky to even meet with Norma, Yolanda suggested a double date, much to Rocky's irritation. He said, "What? Are you kidding me?" While Norma smiled at Yolanda's efforts and pretended she didn't mind, she was annoyed. Yes, Rocky had his own life and would probably continue to ignore her, but Norma also believed that one day he would pause to notice her and then maybe act like a gentleman. The way it was going, that one day seemed quite far off. It might never happen, and they could end up with someone else. Yolanda, however, wouldn't give up. She could be as relentless as a brother's fighting style. She constantly insisted that Rocky meet Norma, and he would nod by saying, "Yeah, yeah, don't bother me, I'll find my own girlfriends." He didn't need his sister to be the matchmaker. But then, one Friday night in June of 1943, after he had knocked out a young fighter named Frankie Falco at the Fort Hamilton Arena, Rocky went home to shower, prepping for an evening with Terry Young. On his way out of his apartment building, Rocky saw his sister talking with Norma outside. His sister, the matchmaker, would not give up. Determined to avoid both women, Rocky pulled his hat low on his forehead, determined to run down the stairs and past the girls, avoiding so much as eye contact. Just before he could exit the building, Yolanda grabbed one sleeve of Rocky's jacket and wouldn't let it go. "Rocky, I want you to meet Norma," she said. Yolanda yanked at his sleeve, almost pleading. Rocky turned his face up and pushed back the brim of his hat. He looked at Norma's face intently and the curves of her figure. He later recalled that she had a nice trim figure. "She's got nice dark eyes and she's smiling at me like she's a little bit shy." Rocky smiled and nodded at Norma and said he might see her around someday. She returned the smile and felt that fate was now moving in her direction. Rocky, however, exited the lobby rapidly. He leapt into his old Ford jalopy and rode off as if being chased by the police. After driving a few miles, not thinking of where he was going and what he was doing, he parked and suddenly realised he was attracted to Norma. One night, he was driving around the Lower East Side in his noisy, rattling old Ford jalopy. The wheels of the car splashed through large, dirty puddles as the rain beat on the tin roof. Rocky decided to stop for coffee on the East 8th Street. He parked the car alongside the curb and turned off the engine. And there, he spotted her. Walking by herself in the rain, it was Norma, dressed in a tan, belted trench coat. Rocky responded to her as if she was lost, in need of protection and shelter. He called out her name, saying, "Norma! Hey, Norma!" Rocky opened the passenger side door of the car and gestured for her to get in, out of the rain. She sat down and removed her wet headscarf. They sat in the car and talked for a while, steaming up the windows. And after nearly an hour of deep conversation, Rocky offered to drive Norma back to Brooklyn and escort her to the front door of her home. When he started the engine of the car, he remembered that the gas tank was nearly empty and he had less than a dollar in his pockets. He wasn't going to ask Norma for money. He was too proud for that. After all, he was a boxer, earning decent money. He suggested, instead, that he accompany her back to Brooklyn on the subway. She smiled a shy smile and then nodded. They drove to East 10th Street where Rocky parked the car and then they walked in the rain to 14th Street to catch the subway to Brooklyn. And so began a romance that would last until Rocky passed away. It was a romance free of the extramarital affairs that plague many of the stories of the greatest fighters. Rocky couldn't believe he had attracted a girl from a world so far above his own social standing. Norma represented a world of comfort, stability and security to Rocky. Despite their love, they didn't share Rocky's greatest passion. Norma disliked the idea of two men getting in a ring and punching one another to a standstill. She never wanted to watch Rocky spar or even train, and she certainly didn't want to watch him fight. Yet, she would never prohibit him. If boxing was what he wanted to do, needed to do, and if it made him the man he was, it was fine with her. She'd never stand in his way. In victory or defeat, Rocky could depend on Norma to welcome him home after a fight. The only fight she witnessed, unwittingly, occurred late one night when she and Rocky were walking down 8th Street in Greenwich Village. It was not an organised encounter, as Rocky had become accustomed to, but a street fight. It happened during World War II, and three sailors, slightly drunk, were trailing behind the couple. The sailors, in loud aggressive voices, asked what a guy was doing out of uniform. He must be a civilian, they said, a draft dodger, or a homosexual. They yelled offensive slurs as if they were drill sergeants barking out orders at a nervous young recruit. They wanted to taunt Rocky, worse still, beat him up and incapacitate him. Unable to elicit a response, the sailors started shouting that Norma must be a transvestite. They laughed loudly, yelling insults and following the couple up Fifth Avenue to 9th Street. Rocky squeezed Norma's hand and told her not to worry. Once they turned onto 9th Street, which was dark and quiet, he told her not to go far. He swung around and waited for the tormentors. They would soon regret their jibes. As the sailors turned the corner, expecting to keep up their harassment, Rocky belted the largest member of the group with a powerful right hook to the temple, his money punch. The big sailor collapsed onto the pavement like wet cement. The fallen man lay moaning on his back. Rocky made quick work of a second sailor, leaving him prostrate with a right, left and another right. The sailor lay beside his colleague, helpless. The third sailor ran away, panicking and shouting for help. Rocky grasped Norma's hand and they ran to the subway at West 4th Street. While Norma was relieved and nervous, she also hoped Rocky had not badly hurt the two sailors. After all, Rocky could have killed them. As a professional boxer, his fists were considered lethal weapons by the law. With Norma as a positive force in his life, Rocky was able to devote himself to building his reputation as an up-and-coming prize fighter. He had been fighting several six-round bouts in small arenas. He had fought welterweights, beating most of them. His powerful right-hand punch was a crowd-pleaser, and it made Rocky's bouts must-see sport and enabled him the opportunity to engage in fights at the revered Madison Square Garden. These fights would not always end in victory, however. Steve Riggio managed to stay away from Rocky's gung-ho style and win two fights against The Rock, one in 1943 and one in 1944, with both losses for Rocky registering on points. Another hard-hitting competitor who cracked Graziano's rock-solid exterior and nuclear right hand was Harold Green. Green was born into a poor family in the Brownsville section of Brooklyn and began fighting in local clubs and arenas when he was 14 years old to support his family financially. In an echo of Rocky's early fighting years, Green was awarded a watch each time he won a bout, and many watches came his way. He would pawn each of them for $10, giving the money to his parents. Green's reputation as a skillful boxer protected him and his siblings from the threat of the Brooklyn thugs. He was looked upon as a guy who should be avoided. When he was 22 years old in 1942, Green began his professional career. In his first fight, he knocked out Willis Johnson, a man regarded as one of the more promising fighters of the 1940s. Green continued boxing, winning fight after fight. He looked like a surefire title challenger, a guy who would soon challenge for the welterweight title. His career was interrupted by wartime service in the US Army from 1943 to 1944. Immediately after his discharge, he began piling up yet more wins. In 1944, Ring Magazine ranked Green as the number 7 welterweight in the world. Yet, he never got a shot at the title. On November 3, 1944, in Madison Square Garden, Green defeated Rocky in a 10-round bout won on points. The following month, on December the 22nd, Green and Graziano met in the Garden for a rematch. Again, Green outpointed Rocky in another 10-round bout, knocking Rocky down in the process. The fights with Green were frustrating for Rocky, for his vaunted power had failed him. Revenge was sweet when on September the 28th, 1945, Rocky, who had gained enough weight to move up from welterweight to middleweight, knocked out Green in the third round. Rocky felt that his future was now secured. He had proven himself against an opponent who many in the sports world thought would be a welterweight or middleweight title contender. Next, much to Irving Cohen's reluctance, was a fight with Billy Arnold. William Billy Arnold was thought to be the best of the middleweights and said to be another Sugar Ray Robinson by The Ring magazine. He possessed fast hands, could dance and evade shots with grace. He was one of those rare fighters who made it look easy. He inspired the admiration of those who watched him box. On January the 5th, 1945, Arnold was to meet the wily professional, Fritz Ivic, a former welterweight champ, for a highly publicised fight in Madison Square Garden. Arnold was the odds-on favourite to win. At aged 31, Zivic was seen as over the hill. He was 9 years older than Arnold and 9 pounds heavier. Because of Arnold's youth, the promoters reduced what would have been a 10-round bout to an 8-rounder. Arnold boxed with his expected skill. To many in the audience, he was soundly outpointing Zivic and winning most of the rounds. When the decision was awarded to Zivic, the audience voiced their displeasure, screaming, "Fix!" Assorted missiles were thrown at the ring. The police were called and escorted the judges and the referee away from the furious Arnold fans. It was an official loss for Arnold, yes, though he was awarded the moral majority. Billy Arnold was now the man to beat, regardless of his now-scented ledger. By 1945, Rocky felt he could enhance his reputation and become a big shot of the middleweight division if he could beat the crowd-pleasing Arnold, who was a 5-1 favourite to defeat The Rock. This time around, the bookies were ready to clean up on Arnold. Many thought the smart money boys had previously cleaned up in the Zivic fight. They were now ready to put their money on the favourite, or so the sports world believed. Of course, while the bookmakers favoured Arnold, a gambling man would have put a large sum on Rocky. If Rocky could prove the odds makers and sporting scribes wrong, he would become a title contender. Neither Irving or Whitey Bimstein was sure that Rocky could outpoint Arnold. He would have to win by knockout. Arnold came out of his corner with his usual grace and boxing. Rocky, as usual, was wild and aggressive, swinging his fist and often missing his opponent. As the fight progressed, Arnold was ahead on points, just as Irving and Whitey had feared. Arnold delivered a series of hard punches, all of which Rocky was willing to withstand, just so he could slam his right fist into his opponent's chin. And so the fight went, Arnold landing a series of punches with Rocky waiting for an opening. In the third round, while absorbing blow after blow, Rocky finally found an opening in Arnold's defences. He stunned his foe with a powerful overhand right that ended the fight. Arnold was devastated. Rocky had now taken the mantle of being the man to watch. The crowd roared in approval. The down-and-outer from the streets of New York had defeated the supreme stylist. If Rocky could beat Arnold, surely he'd triumph over all comers. To strengthen this claim, Irving lined up a series of matches drawing the attention of the sporting landscape. For Arnold, unfortunately, there would be no bright future as a boxer. The Rock had beaten the potential out of him. He did return to the ring and had 19 more fights. He won 12 and lost 7. 5 of those 7 were by knockout. Rocky was now intensely focused on his future and the middleweight championship. But before that, he had several opponents he needed to dispatch of, all of whom were considered top title contenders. Rocky's first bout was against the tough and sometimes wild Al Bummy Davis on 25th of May 1945. The fight was like the preceding description of Davis, wild. The two men fought with a ferocity that led them to a standstill in the fourth round, with Graziano stopping his game foe in the fourth after falling victim to a knockdown himself. Next up was Freddie Red Cochran, the reigning welterweight champion. It was an audition for Rocky's capability for competing at the current world class, one which he passed with aplomb when he knocked out Cochran in the 10th round of a fight that would win the prestigious Ring Magazine's Fight of the Year award for 1945. Graziano would repeat the feat in a very similarly fought rematch less than 2 months later in August of 1945. Rocky had underlined his class and would register 3 more wins against Harold Green, Sonny Horn and Marty Servo respectively. The stage was now set for Graziano to try and sit atop the middleweight throne at the expense of the man who helped cement his legacy as a boxing great, the man of steel, Tony Zale. Now, as I mentioned at the top of this episode, we have done a Legendary Knights tale on Graziano and Zale, so please do go back and listen to that episode on the Legendary Knights podcast feed for all of the great breakdowns and analysis of the fight and all the details that surrounded it. But for the benefit of those who haven't listened to that episode, we will go through some information regarding their 3 epic encounters. Now, nearly 40,000 fans paid just over $342,000 to witness 2 of the toughest gladiators to ever meet in a boxing ring on 27th of September 1946. For Rocky, it would be his biggest payday thus far. He knew he would pocket a large chunk of the take, and if he won, his ambition would be fulfilled. He would be the world middleweight champion with the ability to command even larger sums, and not just from boxing matches, but also from the trapping of the status, TV appearances, endorsements. The winner took all. The combination of money, fame, glory, and the ability to completely shut the door on poverty and his former life were his powerful motivations. Rocky seemed cool and calm, with not a bead of perspiration on him. He didn't yell at anyone, didn't lose his temper, didn't curse and throw things at the wall. He was focused solely on defeating Tony Zale. If he felt fear at the prospect of going up against a winner of 4 middleweight championship bouts, he didn't let anyone know about it. He wouldn't even admit that to himself. Tony Zale was a man worthy of fear. He possessed a toughness forged by grueling work in the steel mills of Gary, Indiana, a trade which birthed his hyperbolic nickname, Man of Steel. But there was more to the moniker than Zale's day job. Fighters claimed that Zale was as hard as steel, not just his body, but also his steel reinforced his punches. His chin was made of steel, and like Rocky, Zale could absorb a tremendous amount of punishment and take victory. He was known as a crafty tactical and strategic fighter, but he also wasn't shy to revert to dirty tricks to come out on top. In his fight with George Abrahams for the middleweight title in 1941, Zale thrusted one of his thumbs into Abrahams' left eye in the first round. In the beginning of the fourth round, Zale headbutted Abrahams, causing a severe cut above the challenger's right eye. There was a crimson mask of blood besetting Abrahams' face, rendering him half-blind. Yet he courageously fought on. In the 9th round, Zale delivered a series of hard, rapid punches to Abraham's midsection, which were difficult to block. Zale was known for his powerful body punches that drove the air out of fighters, leaving them gasping and struggling to persevere. By the end of the fight, Abraham's looked like a wounded war casualty, while the judges, as expected, awarded the win to Zale. The Associated Press wrote that Abraham's won 8 rounds, with Zale winning 7. Once again, the opinion of the judges was called into question, and many fans believed that they had been paid off by bookies and mobsters. Others said Zale had proved to be the more aggressive fighter and so deserved the decision of the judges. Many of Abraham's fans, however, were eager to witness Zale receive a beating by the former street fighter from the tough streets of the Lower East Side. For Zale, the present was what mattered, not some disputed judgment from the past. It had always been that way, ever since he began his professional boxing career in 1934 at the age of 20. His birth name was Anthony Florian Zaleski. Tony Zale sounded more American. It was short and crisp, easy to remember, and a comfortable fit for headline writers. By the time Zale was to fight Rocky in 1946, he had fought in 75 bouts. Of those 75 bouts, he had lost 16. 2 by knockout, 1 by TKO. Prior to his fight with Rocky, Zale had won and retained the middleweight title 4 times. It was an accomplishment that added spice to Zale's reputation and polished his Man of Steel image. For his fans, the steel could not have shone more brightly or been any harder. his bout with Rocky would be his fourth attempt to retain the title. He was now 32 years of age and had been in the Navy for 4 years, and some said he was not as tough, not as strong, and not as fast as he had once been. Others said that the military had made him even stronger than he had been in 1942. The boxing world was eager to see who was right. On April 3rd, 1946, promoter Mike Jacobs confirmed that Tony Zale would fight Rocky Graziano for the world middleweight title when he issued a statement announcing that the pair had been matched to meet in the Yankee Stadium on July 25th, 1946 for a 15-round bout. This would be Rocky's redemption song. As mentioned before, his chance to make something of himself and bring light to the doldrums of his family name. Mike Jacobs anticipated that the night would produce a gate revenue of more than $500,000. It would be historic in that it would be the first time that an undisputed world middleweight champion had defended that title since 1927. Zale was matched with Ira Hughes and knocked him out in 2 rounds. He then knocked Eddie Rossi out in 4 on that rearranged May 2nd date in Memphis. However, the day before the Rossi fight, it was reported that Zale's wife, Adele, had filed for divorce on April the 30th. Her charges against Tony were cruelty, and she asked for $50,000 in allowance and $500 in monthly support for herself and their 2 young daughters. Tony had discovered serious allegations of child abuse by his wife through his brother John and brought the concerns directly to her, birthing her grounds for divorce. With this hanging over the middleweight champion, he had to go in to one of the hardest fights of his career against Graziano. The fight was initially scheduled to take place in Yankee Stadium on July 25, 1946, and the event would mark the first defence of the undisputed middleweight title in almost 17 years since Mickey Walker defeated Ace Hudkins in 1929. Zale arrived in New York on July 8th to train at the Pompton Lakes in New Jersey. Rocky was already training at Greenwood Lake, New Jersey. The media excitement for the contest was in overdrive. The Saturday Evening Post described Rocky as the most sensational knockout walloper and the hottest box office attraction in the ring business below the heavyweight class. Joe Williams of the New York World Telegram predicted that the fight between Rocky and Tony would draw one of the 10 largest gates in the history of boxing, owing to both men's explosive approaches to fighting. Interestingly, despite his challenger status, Rocky was favoured to win the battle by the bookmakers, who installed him as a 12-5 betting favourite. This irked Zale, who vociferously criticised Graziano by saying, "All I want to know is who did Graziano ever kill? So, he's a puncher. A puncher has to go to an opponent, and if he comes to me, as I expect, I'll knock him out inside of 6 rounds. I hope he does. If he doesn't come to me and tries to be cute in there, I'll go and catch him, and I'll have him out along about the 6. The publicity, and indeed the fight itself, was halted when on July 23rd, 1946, it was announced that Tony Zale had suffered an attack of intercostal neuritis, an inflation of his ribcage caused by a virus, and the fight was going to have to be postponed until the 26th of September. However, because of the Jewish New Year, Rosh Hashanah, the date of the fight was pushed back by an additional day to the now recognised date of the 27th of September 1946. Tony Zale went home after the announcement to receive treatment, and 3 days later it was announced that he was suffering from pneumonia and had been admitted to Mercy Hospital in Gary, Indiana. Zale was released from the hospital on August 10th and said he would begin training in early September, before also announcing that he and his wife, Adeline, who had withdrawn the divorce suit, were leaving for a 10-day holiday. Rocky's wife, Norma, never a fan of his fights, was besieged with anxiety for Rocky's welfare before the fight. Her relatives tried to keep her calm and distract her from worrying too much and assure her that Rocky would be fine. Their efforts had little effect on Norma, who almost fell victim to a panic attack. Tony Zale's prediction would prove to be almost psychic, as he knocked out Graziano in the 6th round. ESPN's Rob Diskin described the fight. Graziano, an 11-5 favourite, was floored in the opening round by a left hook. In the second round, he decked Zale with a series of rights, and only the bell saved the champ. Graziano continued to punish Zale for the next three rounds. The sixth round began, with Graziano landing more fierce rights. Suddenly, Zale, who thought he had broken his right thumb in the fourth round, unleashed a vicious right to the solar plexus that paralysed Graziano. A left hook then sent the challenger to the canvas. By the time Graziano had regained his wind, referee Ruby Goldstein had counted. When Graziano rose, he was ready for more, while Zale, although still the champion, had the look of a beaten fighter. Rocky, who appeared relatively unmarked in relation to the victorious blood-soaked Zale, would comment to the reporter John Devaney after the fight with an air of defiance about his demeanour. He said, "Hell, he looked like the loser, me the winner." Rocky would receive a cold reception from his supporters in the aftermath of that war with Zale. Despite his valiant showing, walking through his old Lower East Side home, he was surprised when people he had grown up with ignored him, even crossing the street to avoid his presence. He had been seconds from a win. Why the rudeness? He should surely have been treated to a hero's welcome. The prodigal fighting son returned. Why ever not? An old friend finally dissolved the mystery. For Rocky had told everyone that he would win, and it was a sure thing, he said. He told everyone to bet on him. The guys in the pool room, his pals in the gangs, they had bet everything they had that Rocky would win. They thought the fight was now fixed for Rocky. That was how they saw the world, Rocky said. He would win. So, as far as they was concerned, he was going to win, and that it was a fixed fight. No doubt about it, he not only let them down, they felt, but he had also breached their trust. He was a fake, a fraud, a bad guy. He was in it for himself. Everyone at home now figured they couldn't trust their old pal. He should have told them to put their money on Zale and not betrayed them. Rocky knew his worth. He knew his talent. He knew his ambition and desire to be the champ. He had come so close. All of New York City knew who Rocky Graziano was. They loved him, which is why they also felt let down. Those same fans, now cold with upset, had filled every seat in Madison Square Garden when he fought there. For them, Rocky had the heart of a lion. He believed he would win the next fight with Zale and show the doubters and disbelievers in his old neighbourhood that he was the real champ, that he was not a man of empty premonitions. He would train as he had never trained before. He would make the cynics love him again, and he would bring home his trophy, the championship title belt. Before his planned return, Rocky received a call from Irvin Cohen. He wanted Rocky to come to New York to prepare for a tune-up fight with Reuben Cowboy Shank. It was a fight to help Rocky get in shape for a rematch with Zale. Against Shank, Rocky could try out a new, less bullish strategy. The fight would keep him primed, on his toes. Now, while working out at Stillman's gym, Rocky pulled some muscles in his back. And to relax those muscles, he got a rubdown, but it didn't help. The pain worsened, spreading to his side, and he couldn't twist his torso from side to side. When he threw a punch at the heavy bag, the pain shot like electricity through his entire torso. Irvin decided that Rocky would not fight the cowboy. It made no sense. Better to let the muscles heal through massage and hot baths than take a chance and suffer an injury that would put the Zale fight out of reach. The fight with Zale was postponed. Unbeknownst to Irvin and Rocky, something more than a bad back would cause the postponement of the Graziano-Zale rematch. For the first time since his prison days, Rocky would experience legal problems once again. The cops were vague, even obscure in their responses. One of them finally said he didn't know the reason for Rocky being asked to attend questioning. They were just told to find Rocky Graziano and escort him to the district attorney's office. Then, shrugging his shoulders, almost apologetically, the cop said they would follow Rocky back to his home on Ocean Parkway, where he could park his car, and then they would drive him to the DA's office. To Rocky, the cop shared a tone with one of his old army officers. Rocky clenched and unclenched his right fist, almost unconsciously. He didn't know how hard he was about to be hit. For what reason? And he wouldn't be able to hit back. His curiosity was quelled when a big, bold headline on the front page of the New York Times exclaimed, "Graziano loses his license, censored for silence on Fix." The story was reported by James P. Dawson, whose lead paragraph spelled out the sleazy course of events that led to the removal of Rocky's license to fight and the reason for his detention at the DA's office. A fixed fight. For 18 hours, assistant district attorneys and detectives questioned Rocky. He had never sat through such a long and intense scenario. Already been found guilty, the DA implied he was willing to offer Rocky a plea bargain, but only if he would come clean. When Rocky said he wanted to speak with his lawyer, the DA discouraged him from doing so, telling him it wasn't necessary, for Rocky was in no legal jeopardy. He was told it wouldn't help the mess he was in. They told him a lawyer didn't know the answers to their questions, and thus could be of no help to Rocky. They tried to unsettle Rocky, scare him, let him know they held the fate of his boxing career in their powerful hands. Rocky sneered at any attempts to coerce him into a confession. He evidenced a spine of steel. He would not bend for them. Seeing that their tactics were only making Rocky angry and adamant that he would not cooperate, the DA and the detective changed tact. Where accusations and threats had failed, they now employed flattery, appealing to Rocky's ego. They told him how much they admired his skill, his endurance, his heart as a fighter. He was such a phenomenon that he was sure to beat any opponent. He would do to the middleweight division what Joe Lewis had done to the heavyweight division. They told Rocky he was a wonderful and inspiring role model for kids and young men. Did he want to spoil his reputation in their eyes? To Rocky, the transparent flattery being spouted was a source of hilarity. Rocky was smart enough to avoid showing his feelings. He saw his interrogators as bullies, no different than the cops who had pushed him around when he was a teenager. In those days of his delinquent life, he had suffered real beatings at the hands of cops who knew how to do it without leaving any marks. He had been beaten by fists to the back of his head, a rubber hose had been used on the backs of his legs, and a set of brass knuckles had been driven into his gut, forcing him to gasp for air. In those days, he would either lie motionless on a cement cell floor or spit at the cop beating him and let him know he wasn't hurt. He didn't give in to them then, and he wouldn't give in to them now. In the ring, he could absorb more punishment than any other fighter, and he would take whatever these guys were prepared to dish out, both verbally and physically. He was not about to cave in the face of an inquisition. Rocky was proving too tough for the DA and the cops. They just couldn't get him to break. He refused to admit he had been offered a bribe. He asserted that if someone had offered him $100,000 to throw a fight, he wouldn't take it. The prosecutors quickly pounced, presuming that this angle was actually a confession that someone had in fact offered Rocky that sum of money to throw the fight with Cowboy Shank. Rocky scoffed, telling them they were crazy. Cowboy Shank was a bum, hardly worth fighting in fact. If Rocky had taken a bribe and lost to him, a fix would have been obvious. On top of that, Rocky wouldn't take a dive for anyone. Next, the prosecutors accused Rocky of faking a back injury, pretending he had injured himself so he would not have to disappoint his friends and the gamblers who had planned on betting against him. It absolved him of moral guilt. The prosecutor said he understood that Rocky had no choice but to feign a back injury. His life would be endangered if he won such a bout, and the gamblers were compromised. If he had taken the money and then intentionally lost to the cowboy, fight fans would lose all respect for him, let alone the loss of self-respect Rocky would endure. If he had done such a thing, his reputation as a boxer would be forever tarnished. Would he ever get another important fight if he had lost to the cowboy? They said it was unlikely. So either way, he had no choice. He had to fake an injury to extricate himself from being victimised by a catch-22 situation. They understood and Rocky had no choice but to come clean. Nonsense, contended Rocky. He had a genuine injury and he slammed the desk in front of him. He leapt to his feet, overturning his chair. He called the DA a liar. He didn't have to stand for this shit. He had attended this voluntarily. The prosecutors had devised a credible and clever scenario, but without Rocky's confirmation, there was no evidence to back it up. Having failed again and again to get Rocky to cooperate, the accusers tried to entice Rocky to admit he had taken bribes in the past. Why would he confess to such an accusation, especially when he would not admit to being offered the alleged bribe for which he now stood accused? It just made no sense. Rocky denied the accusation. Sure, there were always guys hanging around boxers, you know, whispering in their ears that they could earn big money for taking a dive. But most boxers just laughed it off. Maybe a few guys whose careers were going nowhere or some old war horses with no futures would fold to the temptation of easy money. A rising ring star on his way to becoming a champion would never take the bribe. He said, "Fighting done everything for me. I got a good life today on account of fighting. You cops know my old record. You know you ain't got nothing on me today because I live a good clean life, so don't go knocking the fight business." Although Rocky had been discouraged from calling his lawyer and was not being protected by legal representation, he had asked that Irving Cohen be present, for Irving would confirm his denials and provide an alibi. After all, Irving had been nearly ever present with Rocky at Stillman's gym, in Rocky's dressing room, in Rocky's ring corner, and in his hotel room. Irving would surely know if Rocky had been offered a bribe or faked a back injury. Irving was Rocky's shadow, always aware of what was going on. Rocky was Irving's most important investment, and he wouldn't let himself or Rocky risk that investment to enable some mafia leeches looking to cash in on a fixed fight. Irving arrived at the DA's office in the middle of the night, looking unkempt, tired and withdrawn, but eager to defend his friend, to safeguard their future. While Irving confirmed everything Rocky had told the prosecutors, his words didn't change the course of questioning or even end speculation. The prosecutors felt that Irving's words as nothing but echoes of what Rocky had claimed. To them, Irving was akin to a good father covering up for his unruly offspring. At 3 o'clock in the morning, the prosecutors decided to insert a new angle into proceedings. Enter Colonel Eddie Egan, the head of the New York State Athletic Commission, to make a dramatic entrance into the fray. The prosecutors thought Egan might inspire Rocky to give up the name of the man who had offered the bribe. Egan not only had the power to revoke Rocky's license to fight, but also he had acted as Rocky's friend and confidant before this episode began. Egan, who had been an Olympian, often called Rocky into his office to give the young fighter lessons on the sweet science of pugilism. During such sessions, which Irving had urged Rocky to attend for the sake of good relations, Rocky would spend most of the time ducking and backing away from poorly aimed left slow hooks and slow moving uppercuts. Rocky contemptuously humoured Egan. Irving, however, was always worried Rocky would emerge from the encounters bruised and perhaps too injured to meet a genuine opponent in the ring. Had he actually witnessed the theatre, he would have laughed rather than worried. When the lessons concluded and Egan was exhausted from throwing his out-of-shape punches, he would fling a tired arm over Rocky's shoulder and tell him what a great athlete he was and remind him not to tell anyone about his private lessons, for such information could lead to questions about favouritism. And it shouldn't be disclosed that the Colonel had taught Rocky tricks unbeknownst to the world of boxing. Such tricks could give Rocky an unfair advantage when fighting. Rocky would nod obediently, an affect an appreciative look in his eyes as he bit his lower lip so as not to laugh at the seriousness of Egan. It was important to have Egan as a friend, for you never knew when such friendship would come in handy. Rocky looked forward to the Colonel's insertion into the current drama. The Colonel, however, was planning on playing a role that Rocky hadn't anticipated. He was no longer the meddling uncle and self-important coach. Egan started off his part of the inquisition by letting Rocky know how much he admired and liked him, how he was just present to help Rocky make the right decision and to get on with his career. The Colonel said he knew Rocky wanted to make the right decision, and the Colonel would help him get to that point. Rocky simply refused to cooperate. Egan took a deep breath and seemed to puff out his chest. He held his head angrily, erect, his expression a cross between disappointment and disbelief. He reminded Rocky of a reform school warden lecturing a rebellious young criminal. He told Rocky that his license could be revoked for not reporting a bribe. He would hate to do it. He had devoted a lot of time to advancing Rocky's career, but if he had to revoke the license, then so be it, and Rocky would never fight again in New York. Rocky insisted that attempted bribes happened all the time, and that if a fighter reported each one, he would spend more time in the commissioner's office than in a boxing ring. Most attempts, Rocky advised, were made by screwballs, people who just wanted to get close to a fighter. No one paid much attention to those psychopaths. The Colonel looked disappointed, as if he had just caught his star pupil cheating on an exam. He turned away from Rocky and patted his right index finger on his lips. Seeing that he was getting nowhere, that his presence hadn't brought about the desired result, the Colonel conferred with the assistant DAs in the corner of the room. Across the room, Rocky and Irvin could hear the buzzing of whispers. A few moments later, there was silence in the room, and Egan emerged from the huddle, scowling and shaking his head from side to side. He walked over to Rocky and placed a hand on his shoulder, which Rocky attempted to shake off. The Colonel, with sadness in his voice and a look of disappointment on his face, told Rocky he was free to leave. The following week, newspapers throughout the country reported that Rocky Graziano's license to box in New York had been revoked. Colonel Egan made the formal announcement. Boxer's license number 514, issued by the New York State Athletic Commission to Tommy Graziano, ring name Rocky Graziano, is hereby revoked. Sports writer W.C. Hines would write about the affair, stating, "The afternoon that Egan announced that Rocky Graziano was banned, ostensibly from life from boxing in New York State, I covered that. In that crowded hearing room, I watched the fighter, who had seemed to have finally found his way in this world, drop his head into his hands, his elbows on the table as he sat there across from Egan, and I rushed back to the paper and wrote the piece that ran under the 8-column headline that bannered page one. To make matters worse, to inflict additional wounds, a former inmate of Rocky from Leavenworth sold a story for $300 about Rocky punching a corporal, knocking out a captain and going AWOL. It was spun that Rocky may be tough in the ring, but when it came to his country, he was not patriotic in the mould of a Joe Louis character. Written barb spewed from the pages of major newspapers and magazines and the echoing microphones of radio announcers. For Irving Cohen, the lynch mob was baying for blood, albeit irrationally. Rocky seethed with rage at this predicament. Hines would comment again on the situation, saying, "And then it all came out. All the expletives, all the vulgarities. The close air in that car was filled with obscene oaths and unprintable invectives. He was throwing them wildly, the way he threw punches in the ring, where he had found a way to fight back against all the hurts he had invited and that society had inflicted upon him. Now cornered and wounded again, he was seeing society as his enemy again, personified by Egan. Rocky was neither a rat, nor a fool, neither a stooge nor a dummy. He had his eyes set on the prize, and that prize was the championship of the world. The trajectory of his career had gone from the gutters of New York to dreams of glory. He would rocket into the stratosphere. Below him would be a heap of knocked-out opponents, men like Billy Arnold and Marty Servo, whose boxing careers lay like car wrecks in Rocky's rearview mirror. Rocky was going right to the top. He was determined to become the superstar of boxing, the KO King, the man who no one could hold back, not the DA, not Colonel Egan, no one. He remained steadfast in his belief that his destiny was to be the middleweight champion of the world. He was the former Thomas Rocco Barbella, juvenile delinquent, petty criminal, ex-convict, draft dodger, transformed into Rocky Graziano, the best, most colourful middleweight the world had ever seen. He had conquered the urge that had once destined him for a life of crime, a life in prison, and perhaps even an ending in the electric chair. Rocky was now on the straight path. He also had his own rules of honour and stuck by those with ferocity. Rocky was like a man pushing up against the powerful wind of a hurricane. It may push him off course, but Rocky could not and would not stop moving forward. He would do it in his own hard-headed way. On being unable to box in his native New York, Rocky would write in his autobiography, "Somebody up there likes me. I cannot box in my own town, New York City. I cannot box in the same city where I fought bootleg amateurs and nobody stopped me, where I fought while I was on the parole and nobody stopped me, and where I fought while I was on AWOL from the US Army." Such words present an air of devastation surrounding Rocky. He felt betrayed, particularly by the man claiming to be his friend, Colonel Egan. He said, "It was Mr. Egan who hurt me most of all. I thought that the Colonel was my friend. He had told me I was his favourite fighter. He had told me I woke up single-handedly the middleweight division. I never thought that he would use me to play politics with." The forces judging Rocky acted as if the fighter had been his former thuggish self. Taking bribes or not reporting attempted bribes would be typical of such a reprehensible character, they said. Rocky was not intimidated by such accusations. He stayed true to his own code of honour. He was not a rat. He refused to take a bribe, to lose a fight. Attempts at bribery happened all the time. The very nature of boxing invited such underhanded behaviour as opposed to other team sports. One only had to bribe one boxer to take a dive. Offers of money tempted fighters constantly. Most boxers, however, unless they were on the way down, didn't take the money. It was not only too risky, but also could prove to be a hazard to gaining a championship bout. Fans couldn't believe that the New York State Athletic Commission would revoke Rocky's license because of a crime in which he didn't participate. Rocky received thousands of letters of support from all walks of life, receiving messages of support from cops, firefighters, construction workers, members of the fraternity of boxers, corporate executives, ex-convicts, and even a handful of convicts and gangsters. Colonel Egan may have thought he was being the good guy, portraying himself as the fighter against crime. Instead, he became one of the most disliked men in New York at the time. This nourished Rocky's soul. The support would feed him for his highly anticipated return bout against the champion Tony Zale. While sat at home, mulling over his regrettable circumstances, Rocky received a phone call from Irving Cohen, letting him know that a rematch with Zale was signed for July the 16th, 1947, at Chicago Stadium. To get in shape for his rematch with Zale, Rocky had a pair of tune-up fights, both of which he won easily. One of the fights was with Eddie Finazzo in Memphis, Tennessee, on June 10th, 1947. Finazzo was so much of a Rocky fan that he had asked for Rocky's autograph before the fight. Rocky was shocked. That had never happened to him. No opponent had ever been a fan. How could you punch such a guy into oblivion, a guy who had just requested your autograph? In fact, Rocky was so touched, he decided not to prolong his opponent's agony. Rocky, with the execution of a skilled surgeon, knocked out Finazzo in the first round, saving him from an unnecessary beating. After that fight, Rocky quickly dispatched of Jerry Fiorello. It was an easy bout for Rocky, who claimed he hardly worked up a sweat. He now felt primed and ready to face Tony Zale. He would prove to the world and himself that he could be the world champion, that he, in fact, deserved to wear the crown of middleweight champion. He would not be a failure. He would not follow in his father's failed attempts to be someone. Once the title was his, those who had taken away his license would have to restore it. How could they not? The fans would demand it. The newspapers would demand it. They could not possibly continue to deny a license to box to the world champion. Rocky was going to teach them that they had been wrong, that they had been foolish. Vengeance would be his. Egan would have to swallow his pride and do the just thing. Irving ignited a fire of anger and motivation in Rocky. He agreed with him that his entire career would be determined by the outcome of this fight with Zale. He must win it. If he didn't win, he might as well end his career. There was nowhere else to go. Rocky said about the rematch, "This was no boxing match, it was a war, and if there wasn't a referee, one of the two of us would have wound up dead. He would not retreat, he would be impervious to blood, bruises and serious injury. He would not lie down, he had trained harder for his rematch with Zayl than for any other fight previously. The training would not go to waste, it had been intense and deliberate, because Zayl had relentlessly attacked the body in their first fight. Rocky had to undergo stomach strengthening exercises, day after day, 100 times a day. Whitey Bimstein threw a 100-pound medicine ball at his fighter's toned midriff. Rocky ran 5 miles a day, sometimes twice a day. He lifted weights. He rhythmically attacked the speed bag and hammered the heavy bag. He jumped and skipped rope. He shadow boxed. He was a tightly coiled viper ready to poison Zayl. Graziano was ready to kill Zayl, or die trying. Zayl himself was certainly not shy in forecasting his chances of a win. Of the rematch, the Man of Steel stated, "I am more confident that I will win this time than I was in our previous bout last September. I broke my right hand in the second round of my first fight with Rocky, and I had to use it sparingly the rest of the way. I am punching better with my right than I ever did. I'll have two hands to work in there this time." In response, Rocky replied, "I'm ready now. I wish the fight was tonight. I'm not going to fight Zayl any differently than I did last time. I only know one way to fight. This business about a boxer can change his style, that's baloney. I only fight one way all my life." The rematch was a replica of the first, aesthetically. At the end of that contest, Zayl looked like the beaten, bloody loser, and Rocky was relatively unmarked. At the end of the rematch, Zayl, although bruised and bloody, was not the garish mess that was Rocky. Rocky's eyes were so badly damaged that the cut below one required stitches and the other had to be bandaged. When he got back to his hotel room, Norma kissed his bruised and battered face and cried about the damage. Rocky, however, would disregard the war wounds, ecstatic in the knowledge that he was now the new middleweight champion of the world, pulverising Tony Zayl in 6 rounds. Rocky put a cherry on top of the victory, bellowing his now famous utterance whilst being interviewed after the fight, "Ma, Ma, your bad boy done it. He's world champion. Somebody up there likes me." Following the fight with Tony Zayl, Rocky nearly died in agony on the night of his greatest triumph. According to Rocky's autobiography, after Norma and his daughter Audrey had fallen asleep, Rocky, sweating from the stifling heat of the hotel and exhausted from his fight, went to open a window. He craved fresh air. His lungs yearned for it. The window was stiff. It wouldn't open. Rocky hammered at the window frame with both palms. He had to ingest fresh air. He pushed at the frame with all his strength. He swore at the window, an inanimate foe, and used the power of his biceps and shoulder muscles to give one forceful thrust. The window shot open, and Rocky lost his balance. He started to tumble forward, seemingly destined for a fateful tumble toward the street below. As he was about to fall, a guardian angel, in the guise of his friend, Frank Coco, entered the room and made his own flying leap. Before Rocky was victimised by gravity, Frankie caught him just in time. The two men fell back onto the floor, breathing rapidly and in mutual shock. After a few minutes, Frankie picked himself up, went into the living room and got drunk. Rocky, ground down by his title win, fell into a deep sleep, failing to wake for 20 hours. Now that he was a champ, Rocky thought the world was his oyster. Its pearl, his alone. He thought his problems with the New York State Athletic Commission would be extinguished. You could hardly deny a champ the license to box, to defend his title. But that's exactly what happened. The Illinois Boxing Commission banned him from boxing, and the National Boxing Association declared that a boxer who had gone AWOL and served time in prison for assaulting an officer, one who and was given a dishonourable discharge from the military, should not be permitted to fight. For those in power, avoiding military service was classed as treason. Rocky could not believe such a decision had been one that was intended to prevent him from fighting anywhere in the nation. He felt that those making the decisions were nothing but self-righteous sons of a bitches. He had paid his dues. he had served time at Leavenworth for his crimes against the military. How long would he be pursued for? Although Rocky felt powerless, there was one man who always stood by him. And while he was not a boxer, he fought with his brain to protect Rocky. He was Rocky's manager, Irving Cohen. He managed, and not for the first time, to circumvent the struggles. He got the National Boxing Association to agree to let Rocky fight Sonny Horn for charity in the Alliance Arena in Washington, D.C. Rocky would make only $1 for the fight, with the rest of the gate going to charity. It would be the ideal PR stunt to cleanse Rocky's image, and it would provide the association with the impetus it required to reinstate Rocky's right to earn a living as a boxer. Before the referee could make his ring announcements, Sonny Horn approached Rocky. With fear in his voice, Sonny asked if Rocky would please not knock him out. Rocky actually liked Sonny, and so he agreed. He had smiled at Sonny, patting him on the shoulder, in tactic agreement. During the bout, Rocky threw no power shots. Instead, he boxed classically, jabbing with his left fist and aiming right crosses that would inflict no harm. After winning on points, he walked over to a grateful Sonny and gave him a hug and a kiss. On the train back to New York, Whitey Bimstein told Rocky his fight with Sonny was his cleanest win. Rocky felt he was back on the professional road. He might not be able to box in New York and Illinois, but the ban on fighting in the rest of the country had been neutralised. With that being the new status quo, Rocky signed for a third fight with Tony Zale, which would take place at the Rupert Stadium in Newark, New Jersey, on the 10th of June, 1948. As champion, Rocky would receive the lion's share of the fight purse. He would earn $120,000, while Zale would get half that amount. If Zale were to lose this fight, his financial clout would wane. His financial incentive to regain the crown he had held with pride was fierce. The first bell of the fight would sound in his ears like a starter's pistol going off. He would be out of his corner, fists blazing, aiming to punch the air out of Rocky's lungs and send Rocky for an early shower. For Rocky, the once angry street fighter, brawler and scrapper, with a chip bigger than a brick on his shoulder, the prospects of the fight did not instill the passion of previous encounters. In the words of fictional boxing trainer Mickey Goldmill, Rocky Graziano had got civilised. Gone was the poor snarling thief, a scavenger and scrapper who had prowled the streets stealing coal during the winter and food year-round, willing to maul anyone who got in his way. In that man's place was a man whose vicious edge had been blunted by the comforts of suburbia. He was now a family man, with a manicured lawn, manicured nails and plenty of money in his tailor-made pockets. Nobody in New York or New Jersey wanted to see The Rock lose his title. Everyone who loved him wanted him to prosper. Irving Cohen and Whitey Bimstein understood Rocky's appeal, and they knew Paul Cavalier, the referee for the fight, would give the champ every benefit of the doubt to hold on to his title, for even in New Jersey, Rocky was more of a hometown hero than Tony Zale. The crowd had come to see the champ dominate his nemesis once more. Rocky had been living it up since becoming world champion. He had earned the spoils of war and intended to live with an attitude of carpe diem. His practice was to seize the day, as the Latin dictated, and enjoy it to its fullest. Rocky had not suspected how hard he would have to contend against Zale. Never a fan of rigorous training, Rocky was absent from many training sessions in the run-up to the last Zale meeting. The old training shy rebel still resided in Rocky. He despised the rigorous regime imposed by Whitey. The 100 throws of Whitey's medicine ball had diminished to a few hard gut shots. The daily 10-mile runs had been cut short. Yes, Rocky had trained, but not with the roaring fire to satiate his championship need that existed in Graziano prior to the Zeck and Zale fight. Of his lackluster attitude, Rocky stated, "After I became champion, I went the way of all fighters. Drinking, smoking, having a good time until all hours of the night, you know. I was the king of the world. I don't think there was ever a more popular champion than me, except Joe Louis." He went into the fight in surprisingly good shape. His weight was within ounces of Zale's. Rocky weighed 158.5 pounds, while Zale weighed in at 158.75 pounds. Even though Rocky's living had been excessive, in its indulgence. His body was still hard, lean and muscular. His stamina was still boundless. Of course, his strength had been diminishing ever so slowly as he was getting older, as well as his flexibility and speed. But he was not aware of the slow diminishment of his power. When the fans saw Rocky, they did not see a man who had been gorging for months and out of shape oaf. His presence was still considerable, and he was able to take on and beat all comers in his domain. When he removed his robe, stretched and flexed his muscles, the crowd whistled and applauded their hero. The ultimate bout between Graziano and Zale is outlined by Jeffrey Sussman, and he writes, "The first bell sounded and the fighters roared from their corners, each determined to win the trilogy. Rocky, however, proved to be an easy target for Zale, who drove him against the ropes with a series of rapid-fire punches. A swift left hook caught Rocky on the side of his head, and he fell to the canvas. He was flat on his back, but rose into a sitting position. He shook his head and leapt to his feet before the referee could begin his count. If you hit him, he would come back at you with fire in his eyes, his jaw clenched tight, and his fast-flying fist in your face. Rocky jabbed and threw right crosses. He attempted to go after Zale and drive him against the ropes, where Zale would have few opportunities to throw his powerful body blows. Rocky threw a dynamite right cross at Zale's head, but it missed a target. His punch had been telegraphed too soon and came too late. Zale saw his opportunities open like an unfolding welcome mat, driving rights and lefts at Rocky's head and midsection. Rocky aimed a hard right uppercut at Zale's chin, but Zale jerked his head back and the blow missed. Once again, the punch was telegraphed too soon and arrived like a man just missing a bus, the doors closing against his hard charging breathing. Rocky was driven against the ropes again, absorbing punch after punch. He seemed to be almost absent from the fight. He looked like a man who was watching himself being defeated. The bell sounded like an alarm clock, shaking Rocky awake, and he looked slightly stunned, dazed. He returned to his corner to absorb a minute of restoration and renewal. The bell sounded for round two, and Rocky emerged from his corner, having discharged the spirit of doom. He was the old Rocky, going after Zale with a will to kill. He landed powerful hard rights and left against Zale's head and jaw. For a moment, Zale looked surprised, but then he turned up the flame on his own aggression. He counterpunched like a jackhammer. The two men pounded one another blow for blow, each demonstrating a drive and determination to defend against a possible loss. For a brief while, Rocky seemed to draw on his inner resources to rally as if he were about to win. He gave the battle all he had, and he forced Zale into a defensive crouch, but Zale just wouldn't accept it. He bravely battled back. To the crowd's amazement, Rocky seemed to outbox Zale in that round, and his fans cheered him on, waiting for him to take Zale out in round three. The Rock, they believed, was on his way to another victory. In that third round, Zale was the aggressor, driving Rocky against the ropes where Zale pounded Rocky, who momentarily lost his footing and nearly fell like a drunk into the arms of the ropes. He seemed to wobble as if his lungs were gasping and his brain needed more oxygen. He was not the sure-footed, sure-fisted fighter he appeared to be when he emerged from his corner at the beginning of round three. Zale caught him with a flurry of punches, rights and lefts followed by a right to the head and a left hook to the chin. That last punch sent the champion tumbling to the canvas. The crowd was stunned into a whispered murmur of surprise and disappointment. There Rock lay prone, one hand clutching a ring rope as if it was a life preserver. He managed to pull himself forward inch by inch. He stumbled and raised himself into an upright position, a dazed expression on his face. At the count of eight, he was deemed ready to submit to the final indignity of a loss. He nearly fell against the ropes again, his rubbery legs barely able to support his own weight. Zale couldn't wait to get his man, to finish him off and reclaim the title. Zale bounced on his feet, a look of imminent victory in his narrowed, gleaming eyes. Rocky had just shaken the cobwebs from his brain, and Zale was on him with a flurry of punches. A hard left hook sent Rocky sprawling onto the canvas, where he lay as surprised as a dead man about to receive his last rites. After the referee counted him out, Rocky's mouthpiece was gently removed by Whitey. He knelt alongside Rocky's body like a priest saying goodbye to a beloved parishioner. For Tony Zale, victory was a much-needed circumstance. He had regained his crown and re-established his earning power in a display of unbridled savagery. He was the first middleweight fighter to regain his title in a rubber match since Stanley Ketchell beat Billy Papke in November of 1908. Zale dismissed questions surrounding a fourth battle with Graziano. He said, "I'll not fight Rocky again. I gave him three cracks at my chin. What more could he ask?" Many years later, when Rocky reflected on their trilogy, he said this of Tony: "Tough guy, Tony Zale. He was a tough fighting Polish boy. No, the truth is, he was the toughest man I ever fought. He was quiet outside the ring, but he wasn't quiet in it." The loss, although treated in the press as if it were the end of Rocky Graziano, was not a correct signal. It was just a low point, but not the death knell. He told Irving Cohen of his desire for a fourth dance with Zale, though, as mentioned previously, such pleas would be redundant. Zale had fought bravely and won back his title, and he was not about to put it in jeopardy in another ring-confined war. Rocky Graziano, former world middleweight champion, would be reborn as a new kind of Rocky, a more well-known and celebrated character than either Rocky Graziano the middleweight champ or Rocky Graziano the beloved New York character had ever been. The future would be bright, though the immediate aftermath of the fight was bleak for Rocky. Following the Tony Zale contest, Rocky would go on to have 20 more bouts, winning all but three. He fought Tony Gennaro, ranked as one of the top 10 middleweight contenders of his era, in another trilogy. The first time, the judges agreed the fight was a draw. For the second fight, the judges agreed unanimously that Rocky had won, and their third encounter required no decision by the judges, with Rocky winning via knockout. Many fans thought Gennaro could be another Rocky Graziano. He was good-looking, hated training, was a powerful puncher, and enjoyed doubts out drinking and having fun. Gennaro finished his career with an impressive 83 wins, 11 losses and 2 draws. Rocky also fought and beat Sonny Horn again. But there was one man who represented the pinnacle of boxing talent, and it was that man who Rocky wanted a shot at. The man who would test his skills like no other. That man was Sugar Ray Robinson, who pound for pound is considered the finest boxer to ever enter a ring. His fight with Robinson, where he was KO'd in the third round, and one later with Chuck Davey, a unanimous decision loss, would actually bring Rocky's boxing career to an end. His final career ledger would read 67 wins, 10 losses and 6 draws. The 52 knockout victories underlined his power. Rocky's retirement would bring forth a new type of power, star power. The once aspiring street hood would be immortalised by Hollywood and end his days in a more fortunate position than most fighters. Rocky's career gained legendary status with the publication of his autobiography, Somebody Up There Likes Me, written with Roland Barber and published in 1955. After a brilliant PR campaign and countless positive reviews, the book shot up on the New York Times bestseller list and made Rocky Graziano a household name. Somebody Up There Likes Me was reviewed in book pages as well as sports pages. Rocky was a guest on television and radio interview shows. Audiences loved Rocky. He exuded charm and humility. He no longer exhibited signs of being a street thug who would beat you up for a dollar. The young man's anger was long gone. Cool awe evaporated and replaced with a jovial nature inhabiting the soul of a guy who was grateful boxing had saved him from a life of crime as well as a life sentence languishing in a jail cell. Boxing had opened a door to a new life, and Rocky grabbed the opportunity hungrily. Rocky's book and his overall story would also prove to be perfect for the movies. It would have audiences cheering for the dead-end kid as he made his way to the pinnacle of the boxing world. Hollywood would not have to spend millions of dollars promoting the movie, for the book had already created enough buzz. In the spring of 1955, the hottest young movie star was James Dean. Producers thought he would excel in the role of Rocky Graziano, although some had reservations and thought the blonde, pale actor would be a miscast as a suave, muscular Italian. Nevertheless, he signed to play the role and agreed to spend hours daily in a gym to build a boxer's physique. But in September of that year, James Dean was killed in a car crash when his 1955 Porsche Spyder was rammed by a Ford sedan whose driver could not see the silver sports car racing down a California highway. In death, Dean went on to be a bigger star than in life. The part of Rocky was then offered to Montgomery Clift, who had played a conscience-driven, reluctant boxer in the movie From Here to Eternity. Clift turned down the part, as he had turned down the leads in Sunset Boulevard and another boxing story in On the Waterfront. Next, among the auditionees, was relative newcomer Paul Newman, who had screen-tested with James Dean for a part in The East of Eden, but was passed over. Several Hollywood executives thought Newman should not be given the part because he had been critically panned for his acting in the 1954 movie The Silver Chalice, a box office failure that was dismissed by the critics. The final decision to have Newman play the part was reached after he received plaudits for his critically acclaimed portrayal of a boxer in the 1955 television drama The Battler. He had surprised directors and producers with the extraordinary authenticity he brought to the role. Many viewers thought Newman must have been a boxer turned actor. Rocky gave Newman precise boxing lessons, teaching him how to jab with his left, deliver a right cross, slip punches, feint with one fist and deliver with the other, bob and weave and play possum to draw your opponent and then slug him on the jaw. He taught Newman how to use the speed bag and heavy bag and the proper way to skip rope. Like the great acting student he was, Newman proved to be a natural. He had been athletic since his teenage years when he worked in his father's sporting goods store. He had been an excellent tennis, baseball and basketball player. He was a skillful skier. To learn the necessary skills of a boxer and develop the well-muscled body of a fighter, Newman trained for 6 hours a day at Steelman's gym. On playing Rocky, Newman stated, "I tried to find universal physical things that he did, or emotional responses that he had to certain things that would allow me to create not the Rocky Graziano, but a Graziano. There were two things that I discovered about him. One was that there was very little thought connected with his responses. They were immediate and emotional. Another was that there was a terrific restlessness about him, a kind of urgency and thrust." The movie adaptation of Somebody Up There Likes Me proved a great success, making Paul Newman a star who would choose whatever roles he wanted to play, and presenting Rocky Graziano sympathetically as a real-life rebel and reformed criminal. The reformed Graziano, now immortalised in prose and on screen, would enjoy many years as a loved ex-champion, called upon for media appearances and entertaining audiences with his laid-back demeanour, unfurling wisecracks at every opportunity. The Rock would go on to live a very happy life until he passed away on the 22nd of May 1990 at a New York hospital of cardiopulmonary failure. He was survived by his two daughters, Audrey and Roxy, and his ever-faithful wife, Norma, with whom he is buried in Locust Valley Cemetery in New York. Norma died in 2009. Rocky Graziano's list of boxing achievements is a considerable one. As an amateur, he would win the Metropolitan Amateur Athletic Union's welterweight crown. His professional career would produce the more notable highlights, however, as Graziano reigned supreme as the world middleweight champion from 1947 to 1948. He was inducted into the International Boxing Hall of Fame in its class of 1991, and was listed at number 23 on the Ring magazine's list of 100 greatest punchers of all time. Rocky also resides in the Nassau County Sports Hall of Fame in its 2007 class. So that brings an end to the colourful life and career of Rocky Graziano, and we'll leave Rocky with the final say and to impart a beautiful lesson to you guys listening. The greatest lesson I learned in life is that you have to believe in yourself, no matter what. And that brings an end to the legendary career profile of Rocky Graziano, a true rags-to-riches tale. Now, when you listen to this, guys, you would have started listening to it, probably like I did when I was researching and looking at the notes for it, which was, I'm not really feeling Rocky Graziano. You know, he's not really a nice character as a younger teenager, a younger man, because of the way he had to live and because of the environment he grew up in. So essentially what he was a product of his environment for a period of time until things changed. And when he became a boxer, life changed for him. He goes on to become the world middleweight champion, overcoming levels of adversity that, as fans, we like to see. We like a good underdog story, and I do believe that Rocky Graziano's story is certainly one of the great underdog stories in this sport. And it's been really educational to learn more about his trials and tribulations, the difficulties, the infamous part of his life where he was accused of taking bribes, having his license revoked, overcoming that level of adversity to go on and continue an illustrious career and go into the Hall of Fame and have those accolades aside of him. He might have not been the most skillful boxer. He might have been rugged. His approach was quite one-dimensional in some people's eyes. But for me, what he epitomises is a true underdog and a true heart and determination story of someone who came from absolutely nothing and had to resort to a life of crime to be able to live his life, to then changing that completely 360 around and becoming a world middleweight champion. And then having a movie made out of his life is something that not every fighter will ever get in boxing. So to have that just shows you the level of legendary status he put himself into during that period of time that he was fighting and post-fighting. To be inducted into the Hall of Fame in 1991, another fantastic accolade. I've looked back on his career, I've watched some of his fights, and I've enjoyed looking at Rocky Graziano as a whole, and I hope you guys listening have enjoyed this career profile on Rocky Graziano. As I've said during the course of this episode, we did do the Legendary Nights episode with him and Tony Zale. So whilst there was some detail in this episode, we did purposely omit a lot of it because we wanted to leave that for that episode for you guys to go back and listen to. Now for some of you might have already listened to the episode and enjoyed it, but for those that are only picking this up now at this point, it's probably now a good time to go back and listen to it because we put so much more information into that episode that we didn't put into this one. So you've got like a bit of a complete bio on Rocky Graziano and his most significant moments by listening to this and listening to the Legendary Nights episode. If you've enjoyed it, please do go and let us know on social media at career_profiles on X or at the BTR Boxing Podcast Network on all other available social media apps. If you've watched this on YouTube, leave a comment below. If you've listened to it on Spotify, leave a comment below. If you've not rated us on Apple, leave us a rating and review. It really, really does help. And I want to give a couple of thank yous out as well for the episode. Thank you to Jamie Albrecht, our researcher, our editor, and our producer for the show. Really great to have Jamie on board, really helping bolster the Career Profiles podcast. And I want to also say thank you to the patrons of the podcast as well, because you guys subscribing to us through patreon.com, you're allowing us to continue this journey and continue to grow as a podcast. I know I talk a lot about us being independent and self-sufficient and not as big as some of the big financed outlets out there. And I do that because we do need the support. We are a niche podcast. We do things that not every other boxing podcast does. We do cover weekly fights like they do, but we're not trying to emulate what everybody else is doing. We wanted to bring something to you guys which you'd really enjoy. So if you are not a patron and you can support us in that way, head over to patreon.com/BTR Boxing Podcast for all the available membership tiers. From as little as £1.50 a month, you can get access to the Patreon page. And the higher the tiers, the more benefits that we can offer, like ad-free shows, like early access to episodes like this, like Patreon-only content. We are developing the Patreon page and we will be producing more bespoke content for that page. So now would be a good time to join us because you will expect some new content, some continuation of a series that we run called Boxing Through the Decades, more video content, and all of that will help us to grow the podcast even more. To those that are patrons, again, I say thank you because you guys religiously support us and we really, really appreciate that. But for now, that is the end of the Career Profiles episode. I hope you've enjoyed the life and the career of Rocky Graziano.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky?
In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.